to another episode of Women Who Stutter, Our Stories. This is Pam, and you can find the podcast on the blog Make Room for the Stuttering at www.stutterrockstar.wordpress.com. And you can also find it on iTunes as a free download. Today I'm excited to have yet another amazing woman who stutters as a guest, and I would like to welcome Beth Bienvenue. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
And if you could you introduce yourself to us?
Sure. Beth Bienvenue is my name. I am from Olney, Maryland, which is right outside the Washington, D.C. area. I am a policy advisor at the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Disability Employment Policy. I've been there for about 5 years now, and I am a member of the National Stuttering Association, and I've been a part of that group for about 6 years.
Cool. So, what were you doing prior to six years ago? What was the NSA your first delve into the self-help movement?
Yeah, my entrance into working with the National Stuttering Association was the first self-help group, but prior to that, I'd been through therapy as a child and in my teen years, and then in grad school, I did a bit on campus with the campus speech-language department. But then I took a long break and just got to the point where I felt like I needed more support, and I went online and found the NSA.
Wow. So, and I'm taking it that you're very happy that you did.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been really helpful. It was through the NSA that I discovered what being covert was, and that helped me figure out that that's what I was doing, and find out how I could live without trying to hide it.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting because I too had been covert for most of my young adult and adult life, and I've talked to a number of other women who have also been covert, and it seems, and I could be wrong, but it seems to be more of the female experience that we try to hide our stuttering. What do you think of that? You think that's true?
I think that does sound a bit right. Women are encouraged to always be perfect and look good and act right and be good girls. And stuttering is not part of that. And I've met a lot of women who stutter who are very attractive and maybe were popular in high school. And, you know, hiding it was a big part of that because you don't want to seem flawed and, you know, we look at magazines and we look at the media and we look at what we are supposed to be as women, and stuttering just doesn't fit in. So we do whatever we can to hide it, to be attractive to men, to be, good friend material with other women, other girls. And I'm not saying this doesn't happen for men as well, but it could be part of the covert experience for women.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that your experience? Is that why you became covert, or were there other reasons involved?
I'm not actually sure why I became covert. I think it was just the desire not to stutter. I didn't like how it sounded. I didn't like not being able to get my words out, and so I probably developed those behaviors early on just as a way of coping. And it kind of blended in with my therapy techniques as well, which was the easy onset and things like that. I think I just blended that into sounding fluent in general.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When did you start stuttering?
We believe it was around age 7. That was when my parents first started to notice it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they often say that you did start when you were younger than that. They just might not have picked up on it.
Right. And what was it like for you growing up, were your parents and your family pretty supportive?
They were very supportive. I think they thought that it had to do with family dynamics, and we had had some stresses in the year or so leading up to it. We lost two grandparents. My sisters and I all had some major childhood illnesses, just chicken pox and pneumonia and flu. And I'd broken my arm when I had the mumps, you know, so just your basic minor family traumas. And I think that they thought that that might have contributed to it. So we did some family therapy. I'm also the youngest, and I have two older sisters. And so there's a bit of a family dynamic as well. As much as I love my sisters, you know, when you're the baby, sometimes you don't get heard, and maybe that was part of it.
What do your sisters think of you stuttering? Do you and they ever talk about it?
Only to the point when it's brought up. It was never really an issue. My oldest sister was very supportive, and helped me find a therapist at some point when she was going to nursing school. I think she met somebody who was a speech therapist, and she encouraged me to go back into therapy when I was in high school. And the middle sister was also supportive. They never made fun of me. They were always, you know, they were probably like protective older siblings, and they were great.
Yeah. Oh, good. Good. Yeah. My experience was different. I've talked about it a little bit on here before, and I've written about it in my blog, but I was the oldest of six, and I started talking before two, but didn't start stuttering until five. And I've always wondered if it had anything to do with family trauma or things that were also going on in my family. But we didn't talk about it at all. It was like the pink elephant in my family, and my father was not supportive at all. He yelled at me a lot. He was one of those that told me if I couldn't talk right, don't say.
Oh no.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
that's right. I had a kindergarten teacher that kind of followed suit and thought I was being disrespectful, and also, you know, was not supportive and yelled at me to stop and whatnot. So I think those early experiences and negative messages that I had gotten was what kind of propelled me to become covert at an early age. And then it seemed like once I started those behaviors, I didn't know any other way.
Yeah, it's amazing how early experiences can really impact your experience and your speech progress. I mean, my parents put me into therapy right away. Within the first year, I think I was going to a therapist, and it really helped.
Oh, good.
I think it made me as fluent as I am today.
Oh, that's wonderful. And in my situation, my father was not accepting at all, and he actually refused to let me go to speech therapy after it was introduced to me in elementary school, because I think it meant to him that he then had to admit that there was something wrong with one of the kids. So I actually didn't get therapy until 4 years ago as an adult, and by then I was trying to be not covert anymore. Mm-hmm. Just trying to stutter openly and be okay with it. So it's funny how we have different experiences and different definitions of the covert experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So you mentioned at the onset that you're a policy advisor with the U.S. Department of Labor's Disability and Employment Office. What exactly do you do? What is a policy analyst?
I sometimes wonder that myself. What we do is a lot of the Department of Labor is focused around regulation of employers, ensuring that they comply with laws, the various labor laws that are out there. My office primarily does policy work. We don't regulate. We don't come down on employers. We don't require them to do anything. we're kind of a bridge between the policies and the laws that are out there and the employers that are doing the work, as well as the people with disabilities. So we're kind of a bridge between all of those groups. Oh, and also the service providers, such as vocational rehabilitation, the career one-stop services. And we look at the policies that are out there, the laws, the regulations. We try to find ways to make them interact better, to reform the policies. There are so many laws out there that prevent people with disabilities from going back to work. Not prevention as in they're keeping them from doing it. There's just disincentives to work. So we try to either change the law, to work across agencies, like with the Social Security Administration, Department of Education, et cetera, to find other ways to encourage people with disabilities to go back to work, to provide the supports that they need, the health care, the transportation, et cetera, as well as working with the employers to ensure that they're ready to hire people with disabilities and to bring them back to work when they've been injured. And a lot of the barriers that are out there, you know, there's a number of barriers for people with disabilities. It, everything from, you know, not having the training and education to not having the transportation, or just not having the technology that they need. Because, for example, someone who's blind can use a number of different pieces of software to enable them to use the computer. People who are deaf have lots of technology they can use. People with mobility disabilities. And if they have those things in place, they can do their work as effectively as anybody else. And we try to work with employers to ensure that they can provide those supports, and that people can also get those supports from other places. So there's just a number of things that we do to work between agencies, between sectors, to try to get people with disabilities employed.
Wow. That encompasses a lot.
Actually, I was covering what our whole office does. My job is to focus on the employer side. I mean, I don't do all of that. I just do the one part.
I was going to say, yeah, wow, you're pretty.
I'm really busy.
How did you happen to land in a job like this with the U.S. Department of Labor? Was it something that you actively pursued, or did it kind of find you?
It kind of found me. My supervisor asked me recently why I was in this job, not for any negative reason, but it was, do you have a driving passion to change certain laws and policies, or is it more of a general thing? And I realized it was kind of a general interest. I don't have a passion to, change a particular law. Like I think there are some people in this field who see some real injustices and they're saying, I'm going to go into this job so I can change this.
Right.
I just like the work generally. What I did was what a lot of Washingtonians do. You start off working for a consulting firm or a government contractor. And then I was at the Department of Labor in another agency working on some contracts that this company had, and I ended up meeting people in my office. We call it ODEP. That's the acronym for my office. And a job opened, and I applied for it, and I had the right skills and my background lined up with it. And it just seemed to fit. So it wasn't something I actively pursued, but a lot of people, when you live in this area, you just start looking at government jobs, and oftentimes you find something that lines up and works really well. And I learned quite a bit the first year. I learned all the different regulations. I went to conferences, and got up to speed. And I've been trying to do good work ever since.
Oh, great!
I hope I've done good work.
Well, if you've been there for six years,
5 years.
If you've been there for that long, then we would have to presume that you're doing pretty good.
Well, done okay.
Did you introduce stuttering early on, like when you interviewed for the job? Was it a factor at all?
It could have been. When I brought it up in my job interview, they asked me, just general questions about myself and why I was interested. And I said I knew that that stuttering was something that, you know, gave me some perspective on it. Not everybody who stutters see themselves as having a disability. It may or may not be a disability for people. The definition of disability, according to the Americans with Disabilities Act, now there's the new amendments to it, but I'll just call it the ADA, says that it is something that impacts a major life function. And to many people, speech is a major life function. And if your stuttering is severe enough, you can say that you have a disability. And if you are discriminated against because of it, then you can, if you believe that your speech has impacted something in the workplace and you feel like you've been discriminated against, then it is a disability. It may not be that way for everyone. And I don't see myself as having a really significant disability with my speech because I've learned to manage it well enough. Mm-hmm. But I think my history with my speech, when I was younger, I definitely felt like I was different. And I had a limitation. I even called it a handicap because I felt like I was handicapped the way you are in golf or something, you know. You're starting off three steps behind everybody else because your speech limits you, or you allow it to limit you. So when I was interviewing for the job, I really felt like I could identify with the situation and say, yes, I do have at least some knowledge of having a disability. It may not impact me as much now, but I have that experience, and that's what made me so interested in this type of work. Mm-hmm. So I brought it up, and I don't know if that impressed them or if it helped or what, but and it was, you know, my boss when I first started, the one who interviewed me, was blind, and I worked with people with all sorts of disabilities, and it's very eye-opening, and it's been great. And I actually introduced stuttering to my colleagues to say, look, this is a disability. We should treat this like all of the others that we're working with, and come up with, you know, different things that can help people who stutter, as well as people who are blind or deaf or have mobility disabilities.
Wow. Kudos to you. How empowering to be able to be in that position and educate colleagues that may not have been aware that for some people it can be disabling.
Yeah, it really, really does feel good. And, you know, I really think that this type of work has helped me with my speech. Early on, I had a colleague who has a speech disorder. I shouldn't call it a speech disorder, but she has cerebral palsy and it impacts her speech. She's very soft and a little bit, you know, hesitant. And when she's in a meeting and she's trying to speak up, everybody is quiet and they listen to her. Mm. And I thought, you know, if they can do that for her, they'll do that for someone who stutters. Absolutely. Why is that not any different? And I realized that I have something to say and I can say it. And that actually boosted my confidence in my speech.
Wow, that's good for you. But I something just popped into my head when you were saying that. You know, you mentioned that your friend with the cerebral palsy. Now, maybe one of the reasons why people have a harder time recognizing stuttering as having the potential to be disabling is because it's hidden.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, it could potentially be considered one of those hidden disabilities, like autism or alcoholism or you know, even mental illness or emotional disorders. Mm-hmm. Does your office deal with those hidden disabilities as much as the more visible ones?
Yes, we do. We actually do talk quite a bit about hidden disabilities. As I was speaking earlier, I talked about, you know, people are blind, deaf, or have mobility disabilities. Those are the main ones that people tend to focus on. But we also address psychiatric disabilities, cognitive disabilities. We do try to emphasize all of those. We have resources and fact sheets on accommodations for people with psychiatric disabilities or mental illness. We have a number of other types of resources. There is a mental health work group with it's an interagency group between different federal agencies. So that it's actually addressing those issues. We have groups that are addressing issues of veterans with or disabled veterans, and looking at issues of PTSD and post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury that can lead to those types of disabilities. So we definitely do address all disabilities, and we also talk about strategies for disclosure of hidden disabilities. And that's why I, for a lot of people, stuttering can be a hidden disability, especially, you don't see it until someone opens their mouth. Mm-hmm. I try to, when I do workshops at the NSA conferences on careers, I talk about disclosure and how it's important to have a way to talk about your stuttering with an employer, especially if you go in for a job interview. You want to be able to say, you may notice that I'm stuttering. It's not because I'm nervous or anxious. It's, and then you go on to explain what stuttering is. And I think it's important to state that up front, because otherwise they may make judgments.
Right.
And it's that way with other disabilities as well, I think, other hidden ones.
Yeah, but it's one thing for people to say and to hear you say that you should, disclose that you stutter up front. It makes it easier. But how do you inspire the courage or the confidence that somebody needs to make that leap of faith, to feel confident enough about themselves to be able to disclose to a potential employer something that they may have been embarrassed about for their entire life? How do you encourage them that it's okay to do that?
That's a hard question for me to answer personally, because I've never had a problem talking about my stuttering. The first workshop I did at an NSA conference was the covert panel, which I know you've done.
Yes.
Where you talk about your covert experiences. And it occurred to me that I don't mind talking about stuttering. I feel like, I can just talk about it. I just don't like doing it, And so I never was ashamed to say, yes, I stutter. It was just, I just didn't like doing it because I didn't like how it sounded. But I think for others, it is nothing to be ashamed of. And being in a group of people who stutter just like you at a conference or a support group really, I think, can give people the confidence to say, when you look around the room and you see successful people with who have friendships and relationships, and you say, they can do it. And they are people who stutter, who've accomplished things, and I can do that too. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's nothing to be ashamed of. I don't think there's anything wrong with, in an interview, just saying, look, I happen to stutter. It doesn't impact my ability to do my job. I can communicate effectively, and this is what I can do for your company or your organization. And I know that's a hard thing to do, but I think I really believe that for many people, groups like the NSA and support groups can really help bring about that confidence.
Yeah, and I especially, I totally agree, and I especially agree for women who stutter, because we are in the minority in the stuttering community. Only 1% of the population, obviously we know this, stutters, and only 20% of that 1% happen to be women. So it can be very empowering and inspiring for women to, meet other people that sound like them and share that support and that rapport with other people that will really get it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're so right in that, because I remember when I first went to my first NSA meeting, I was just so overwhelmed that there were actually other people that stutter, I just cried. It was just so overwhelming.
Yeah. And I think I had part of my positive early experiences was when I was in grad school, we did group therapy. Mm-hmm. As part of our, we did one-on-one and then we'd get together in a group. And that was the first time I'd been around a number of other people who stuttered. And so that was an early experience. And I think it's really important, mm-hmm. And I go to these conferences and I see these kids and teenagers, if I'd had that and if you'd had that at that age, can you imagine where we would have been?
Oh.
It's just such an amazing thing to see other people with your, the same experience.
It so is. Now, I want to go back just a quick minute to something that you said. I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget it.
Okay.
You mentioned that that the question that I had asked you, how do you inspire confidence in people to actually feel like it's okay to disclose? And you said that you don't have any trouble talking about stuttering. You just don't like stuttering.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still feel that way? Do you still feel like you don't like how you sound when you stutter?
Not as much as I used to. Mm-hmm. I think the frustration I have, as you can tell, I do like to talk. I talk a lot. And if I'm in a, I stutter worse when I'm in a group.
Mm-hmm.
And, because everybody's competing to get their words in.
Right.
And I just don't like the frustration of not being able to say what I want to say when I want to say it and chime in and at the right time, at the time I want to say it. And that's the hard part for me. I don't have the really hard blocks that I did when I was younger and that I really felt were ugly, mm-hmm. And so that's, I think I feel better, a little bit better that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I still don't like to do it.
Well.
except at the conferences, because then I feel like I fit in better.
Absolutely, because if you're going to go to a stuttering conference, then you have to be sure that you stutter.
Well, I stutter the least around other stutterers.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's because we're such good listeners.
Yeah.
So I find myself doing voluntary stuttering just to show, yes, I do. And sometimes when I do, I start a voluntary block, it turns into a real one. So that's fine.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was doing voluntary stuttering for a while myself when I was in therapy. And that almost always happened when I would try to voluntarily repeat on something. It almost always turned into a real stutter. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was fine, too. It is what it is.
Yeah. I just want to go back for a second mm-hmm. about inspiring confidence in people. I think that having a challenge such as stuttering gives you an edge in some ways. We always say to turn a negative into a positive, especially in a job interview. And we always talk about, sometimes they say, do you think stuttering has made you a better person or something? And I really believe that having a challenge like this has taught you things, valuable things that you can bring to the workplace. And it has taught us to be more sensitive. It's not to say that there are not insensitive people who stutter, but it's taught us to be more empathetic toward other people who face challenges. And I think it's a positive thing. I mean, not that I wish that the world all had challenges, we all do, but I think that it can be something that's given us something special. A lot of us have turned the lemons into lemonade. And I think it's important to bring that out when you're talking with people about it.
Oh, absolutely. What a nice way to say that, too. It gives you an edge. I don't think I've ever quite heard it put like that.
Well, I've never called it that. I've never called it an edge before. I really do think that for a lot of people, especially, I don't want to bring race into this, but I'm white, I'm middle class. Often you know, they think, oh, what have you, you know, what oppression have you experienced? It's like, well, okay, I haven't experienced the same type of oppression that other groups have, but I have experienced this disadvantage and this thing that I've had to overcome, and it's made me stronger in these ways.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you would bring that up, the issue of race or other oppression, because if you recall, you and I first crossed paths several years ago when you helped me out when I was battling a discrimination complaint that I had at my workplace because I'd been fired for stuttering publicly. Mm. And actually, you'd given me quite a wealth of resources. You had given me some resources and fact sheets and some policy on the ADA, and it turned out to be quite helpful with what I was doing. And as it turned out, I wound up settling the lawsuit and the complaint I had because both the person from the New York State Human Rights Commission that I was working with and my lawyer both had told me that even though I had a case, clearly, and that my employer had done something wrong, it was not as egregious as it would have been had it been racial or sexual discrimination.
Wow.
And you know, I mean, and at that point I was like ready to move on and put it behind me, and I needed to close that chapter so that I could move ahead. But it's just interesting because when you mentioned you didn't want to bring up race, that's what popped into my head. Like that was what I was told, you know?
Yeah.
And it certainly didn't make me feel any better, but it just kind of speaks to, the difficulty it is sometimes to have what, you know, may be considered a hidden disability.
Right. And, you know, it makes me wonder if it had been a more severe disability, would they have said the same thing?
Right.
Like if you were blind or, you know, paraplegic or something, would they have said the same thing? Is stuttering not considered a disability? Not severe enough?
Right.
And this was before the Amendments Act was added on to the ADA last year. Back when, a lot of cases were not being found in favor of the person with the disability who filed the suit, because the burden was on them to prove that they had a disability or that they had been discriminated against, and the Amendments Act is supposed to improve that. I can't speak to it as easily as some of my colleagues, and actually there's a couple people who will be doing workshops on the new amendments at our conference, and I'll leave it to them to explain it better than I can.
Great.
Employers are more focused on race and gender as issues of with discrimination, affirmative action, etc. Disability is something that we have to always push to say, look, this is also a group that needs some kind of either protection or assistance, because we're trying to put disability into diversity. When any diversity initiative is usually focused on race and gender, and we're trying to promote disability as part of that as well.
Yeah, because I mean, it has to be, because that's like that's just like a huge segment of our population that's marginalized and underrepresented, and they have to be included. That's what the whole inclusion movement's all about.
Right. 20% of the population have some form of disability.
Yeah.
And it's the only minority group that any of us can join at any time. And I'm not talking about stuttering. I'm talking about stepping in front of a bus or being in some kind of accident or having an illness. And it's just a matter of time before we all start to lose our vision and our hearing and our mobility as we get old. So it's something that touches everybody. So, you know, we all have to pay attention to it.
Wow. This has really been a dynamite conversation. It seems like we've just covered so much in such a short period of time.
That's what you get when you get some talkers together.
Yeah. I want to just ask one more quick question there might be people out there wondering this, and you might be the best person to answer it. What would be a reasonable accommodation in the workplace for a person who stutters? Or is there such a thing?
Well, it's a tricky question. It depends on the job. And the you know, we always look at, you know, what are the essential functions of the job? If the essential functions involve speaking, that's not necessarily to say that you can't do it, because there's a lot of people who stutter who can still speak on the job, whether it's giving presentations or conference calls or talking with or doing sales, it can still do the job. But there could be some tasks that you could that they could give to another person. There's one example they always give is answering phones to cover the receptionist when he or she goes to lunch. That's often rotated among the staff, and you could just, you know, pass that off to someone else, and you do some other duties. The one problem with trying to avoid speaking opportunities or, you know, any kind of talking situation is then you're cutting yourself off from opportunities. It's not that answering phones during the lunch hour is an opportunity, but let's say you pass up on a public speaking opportunity, doing a presentation, that could hurt you, your advancement. So you don't want to give those types of things up. But if it's something that's more minor, that just really makes you uncomfortable, there may be a way to reassign that. Another thing that you can do if you work in an office environment is to ask for a desk or a cubicle in a quiet part of the office. Not everybody can get an office with a door, especially where I work in government. We're a big cubicle farm. So I actually asked for a cubicle on the end of the row, and I got that, and it was great. It's much quieter, and I only had one person who could hear me stutter on the phone, which made me feel so much better than knowing that everybody could hear me stutter on the phone. And you know, because it's the phone that still gets me. Another thing you can do, especially for phone calls, maybe you could go into a private room to make certain calls where you feel more comfortable. There's a number of things that you can do. There's also auditory feedback devices that you could put on the phone, you know, like those ones that people wear full time.
Actually,
one place you can go to look at, we have a fact sheet on accommodations for people who stutter that's through the Job Accommodation Network.
Great.
That is a resource that that we fund. It's run out of West Virginia University. It's called JAN, the Job Accommodation Network. The website is askjan.org. It used to be longer. They just shortened it to askjan.org, and it has accommodations for almost every disability you can think of. And you can call them and brainstorm, and they have a wealth of knowledge. So there's a fact sheet on their website. I brought it to the conference before. So it just comes up with some ideas for you.
That's terrific. I'll definitely link that to this episode. And just as a by the by, I work in a school, and we have the dreaded public address system. And I never officially asked for that to be an accommodation, but it's just kind of like amongst the other people in the office, people just know that I prefer not to use the PA system. So it's just kind of like my own indirect accommodation. I don't think I'm limiting myself, but I would prefer not to hear myself stutter over, you know, and have it be broadcast throughout the whole building. And my philosophy, you know, my philosophy is there's so many other people who could make an announcement, and I can do something else.
And that's a very typical thing, accommodation that can be done, you know, easily, you know, and it's, I don't think it's a cop out, you know, just to say, okay, I'd rather not do this. And I think I actually had that in my last job. It was a small company, and if there was a call that somebody needed to pick up, we had to use the loudspeaker, and I hated it. And so I would ask other people to do it. And, you know, it could be a cop out, or it could just be, you know, it just makes everybody's lives easier.
Yeah, and it can just reduce stress for us too, and that's really kind of what it's all about once we reach a certain point in our life's journey and certainly our stuttering journey. Well, Beth, this has really been terrific. I want to just thank you for, sharing so openly and honestly with us and, giving us all this great information that, I'm sure people can put to use. Thanks again.
You're welcome. It was great.
And this has been Women Who Stutter, Our Stories.